visit elections.pacifica.org.
And once again, this is WBAI New York and WBAI.org on the web. The time now is 6 p.m. usually is the WBAI Evening News with Linda Perry. In its place is another evening edition of You're Crazy If You're Up This Early with Randy Credico. So stay tuned.
Anton Karas in The Third Man by Sir Carol Reed. All right. I got to read this this statement. I just got a text message from my good buddy Cornell West, who I was arrested with and spent a day in jail. And I got some pictures of us in jail together. They didn't take my camera, but it says, "Please tell Brother Assange I send my love and respect for his courage and determination. I shall never forget our interview in the embassy in London. He will be free soon." He's talking about Julian Assange, and we, I hope, have him on the phone right now. Julian, are you there? Hello? You got it? We got him here? How's that? Just, there's always little technical problems here at WBAI. Okay. We got you there, Julian? I can hear him a little bit. I don't know if you can hear him. Listen, it's... Just bear with us. So we have Julian Assange from London, from the Ecuadorian embassy, and we are very happy and pleased and honored that he is here at WBAI. Julian is a... Okay. All right. Can you hear us now, Julian?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. These things happen here at WBAI. We've been around independent radio. You've been on the station many times, mostly on Democracy Now!, and you were at the studio on 120 Wall Street like 20 years ago, somebody told me, 15, 20 years ago. So
It was about six or 7 years ago. It feels like 20.
Does it? It's 6 or 7 years ago, 120 Wall Street. Well, they've moved around since then. Now they're in Brooklyn on Atlantic Avenue. We wish you were in the room with us at this point. And I just want to thank you. So many people are listening. They know that you're on the phone. Now, I am not Mike Wallace. I'm not like one of those hardcore. I'm not an interrogator here. Some people are going to think this is an infomercial for WikiLeaks and for Julian Assange. But, you know, this is a progressive radio station, and I must tell you that everybody here is thrilled that you're on, and we all consider you to be a hero, which you are, and we thank you. We thank you for the great work that you've done throughout your life on behalf of spreading information out there. You've been a beacon of truth. You've been a messenger of truth, and we apologize that our government has been hounding you for so long.
Well, I don't know what you can say about that, but I'm struck by this philosophical position of I am not Mike Wallace.
Well, I'm not Mike Wallace. Do you remember Mike Wallace?
Quite a thing for everyone but Mike Wallace to say.
Yes, but you know, Mike Wallace would put you in. They're all interrogators. I'm watching you. Even a comedian who I started out with, Bill Maher. You know, I wasn't comfortable watching you on that show with Bill Maher. I think he was a little tough on you.
Well, I don't mind interrogations, actually. I think there are times that type of approach is called for. For example, when you're dealing with very slimy politicians that are extremely skilled at dodging questions. But
right. No, I agree.
My experience, my rather limited experience, but experience at interviewing people, I think it's actually more interesting to kind of give them enough rope,
right,
to kind of hear their arguments at what they feel is their best, And then you can contrast with someone else.
Right, I see. Yes, well, we'd like for you to be here at this station when you get out of London and have your own show here, and you can do that with politicians. Didn't you once run for, you were going to run for office in Australia for Senate?
I did. I found something quite unusual, which is that in Australia, if you can submit a postal vote, then you are also entitled to run for election, provided you haven't been convicted of a serious crime, which I haven't. Yeah. So, and there is some unusual, there's an old precedent of a governor in the UK running in the 1900s in Australia. So, yeah, we tried to do that. I didn't think there was much chance, but I thought we'd draw some attention.
Well, I think it's a good idea. You know, I ran for Senate here against Chuck Schumer,
yeah,
who makes Hillary Clinton look like a progressive. I mean, he may be the next leader of the Senate, and I know he's no fan of yours, and I don't think...
I ran for the Senate as well. That was the Australian Senate.
Yeah, well, 2010, again, I ran against Schumer, and he had me thrown off the ballot. But, you know, I was doing it as performance art. Were you doing it as performance art, or were you... seriously trying
not
to
as, not as performance art a bit too because you know during election period as you get closer to the election all the other issues close over and it's just what the two major parties are talking about, so in order to kind of
that's what I meant though. I mean, you're basically trying to shine some light on the two-party system. You didn't run as in one of the two major parties. You ran as an independent, is that it?
We ran with the WikiLeaks party. We created a party basically just because on the voting forms, if it's a party, you appear high up in the voting form. If it's individual, you don't.
I see.
Of like buried among 67 others.
And did you, you didn't hit the road campaigning with posters and bunting and all of that?
Well, there was a team of people in Australia of volunteers, and I got about 150,000 votes.
Wow.
State that I was in.
That's amazing. I got 29,000 in New York State, so you did a lot better than I did. I ran against Governor Cuomo in 2014. But you know, I was totally hammered by the press. If they did any coverage at all, New York Times didn't do a thing on me in 2014. They basically helped out Andrew Cuomo, as they have with Hillary Clinton, as you have with Chuck Schumer. And sitting in that room there, looking at this election in the United States, what is your overview of this election in the United States? If I may just get away from...
In some ways, it's super interesting. In other ways, it's fairly boring. You've got two candidates deeply disliked by both the population, by both groups of population. Hillary Clinton, who's kind of a predictable... boring liberal war hawk, although I think probably now you have to question whether she's a liberal war hawk because she's brought all the neocons onto her side as well.
She's close to Henry Kissinger, you know.
Well, it's much worse than that. She's like Robert Kagan, and who's the wife of Victoria Nuland, who was one of her best buddies at the State Department, who's behind a lot of the problems with Ukraine, has... piled up with her, has made fundraising dinners for her, William Crystal.
Right.
Has also
endorsed
called
her.
Everyone to vote for, endorsed her, vote for Hillary. There's about 30 now. Basically, nearly all the neocons that were behind the Iraq War have now backed Hillary.
So
that tells you something very interesting. It tells you something about Hillary Clinton, but it also tells you something about Donald Trump, and it tells you something about the neocons. So the neocons' sense of identity and their interests are not strongly co-aligned with the Republican Party.
Right.
So they don't view... Because I've believed, naively, that the neocons were deeply Republican. And why, you know, if their interests differed to the candidate... Donald Trump, for whatever reasons, they might not aggressively push him. That's very different to crossing the floor and, if you like, backing the enemy as far as the the Republicans are concerned. So all along, the neocons were not really Republican. They were something else, and they had a different agenda.
You think that if she wins, she's going to continue the warmongering policies that have basically been going on for about the last 40 years. You know, she's
unfortunately, I think she'll accelerate it. There'll be a moderately significant uptick compared to her under the Obama administration. But remember this period from 2009-2012 of Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State in the Obama administration produced a lot of conflict. Hillary Clinton got out at the end, and so John Kerry had to deal with it. But if you look at the successes by John Kerry, diplomatic successes, at his term in office compared to Hillary Clinton's, there's a world of difference. Now, to be fair to her, you could say some of the reason for this is that Obama is trying to move into his legacy phase, and after having, you know, satisfied, broadly speaking, the military-industrial complex in the United States and a bunch of other powerful actors, he's now moving into a position to shore up his historical reputation after he leaves office. So John Kerry might have been given a little more rein than Hillary Clinton was. But yeah, there's significant diplomatic successes under John Kerry in terms of peacemaking, deal-making, reduction of tension. But Hillary Clinton's time in office saw the opposite.
Right. So you think going forward, it's going to be
even
though she's in a week.
That's just analysis on results in office. But there's a lot of other indicators. What she has said in her emails, the types of people that she chooses to associate, the types of people who endorse her, her positions on legislation and on war, but her being the leading. Her not only being the leading voice in the administration to bring about the bombing of Libya and the destruction of the Libyan state, but being towards the end of 2011 so proud of that effort that within inside the State Department she produced or had her staff produce a Libya brag sheet. It's all the and what they call a TikTok. It's the chronological description of how she was the central figure in bringing about the destruction of the Libyan state.
You know, I'm trying to think of, is there anything that she did that was good during her tenure as Secretary of State? I can't think of anything. What about Honduras?
I'm sure there must be something. It's, you know, politicians sell themselves and the State Department sells itself. So there's already an oversupply of an institution bringing out her good points. So, of course, investigative journalists concentrate on the negatives.
You know, I've been...
none come to mind. I'm sure there must be some.
Well, I can't think of any. I've written articles about her. You know, she was running for Senate here in 2000, and now she pushed herself as this big progressive when it comes to civil rights, Black Lives Matter. You know, she lives just a mile away from two prisons, female prisons, Bedford Hills and Taconic prisons. She never once dropped by, not one time did she drop by to say hello to the prisoners, and they're 94% Black and Latino in both of those prisons, maximum security prisons, just a mile away. And so I get a lot of heat that I, by attacking Hillary, which I do here whenever I have a chance at this radio station, I get a lot of heat that I'm actually helping out Donald Trump by attacking Hillary Clinton. I mean, this is the Democratic Party's problem, that they chose a very weak candidate with a real sordid background. You are getting a lot of heat. You know, people are saying, well, Julian's basically going to help Donald Trump. Is there really a difference between these two?
Yes, there are differences between them.
In your mind?
There are significant differences between them as individuals. I think as it speak in both directions, the issue, I think, is more the Republican Party and Look, individual presidents, once they are in office and they're established, don't really do much. Most of their time, they are just taking the briefing sheets that are given to them, reading them to teleprompters, the briefing sheets that they're given for meetings, or then sometimes they are given two or three alternatives by the secretaries and members of cabinet and asked to choose between them. So, you know, it's not like the alternatives that are presented to them are diametrically opposed. So that they're alternatives plucked from a very narrow pond. And where are they produced from? Well, they're produced from the major U.S. corporations and their ability to inject proposals to go into governmental decision-making and lobby for particular ones to be selected, and from the bureaucracies, the CIA, Department of Homeland Security, Army, Pentagon, Veterans Affairs, etc. So there's just one point where the candidate really does make a difference, and that is in the appointment phase. So there's about 3,500 positions that are appointed in the few months of the government coming into office. And so Hillary Clinton will select certain cronies, people she owes favor, etc. And those people will be appointed to various positions, and they in turn will recommend to her other appointments. And similarly, with Donald Trump, he will be appointing a whole bunch of people that come out of, you know, his real estate network, people he's met in the entertainment industry, new friends that he's made during this campaign. And where there are gaps in his own personal network of trust, he will be feeding from what the Republican Party offers him.
Do you think he's really trying to win, or do you think he's tanking it?
I think it's a very interesting question, whether it was a serious campaign in the beginning, whether, you know, there are allegations. I don't have any evidence. It's amusing to speculate whether Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, who allegedly spoke to him about whether he should run, given that they have a close association in the past, that Clinton's might have thought it would be helpful to have Donald Trump in there. I think it is clear now, given the amount of effort that he's putting into things, the amount of time that it's consuming, that he's either was genuinely always intending to run as far as possible, or he has become trapped into it.
Right. Well, I'm not like a big conspiracy person, but I got to tell you, here it feels like watching this that he's part of the team, because he's about the only person that she could possibly beat with her record.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think that's pretty true, although that amongst those 17 Republican candidates, there was a lot of chaff. There are also some
maybe
rather
Rand
poor candidates, not in terms of saying so much the very inflammatory, divisive things that Trump says that alienates whole groups of the population.
I mean, some of the people around him, Rudy Giuliani, this guy, yeah. Chris Christie, this sheriff from Arizona, this nutcase racist sheriff,
yeah.
Arpaio, it's very difficult to like him, you know. But there are other candidates. There's Gary Johnson and there's Jill Stein. Jill Stein called you a hero. What do you think about her campaign?
Well, I think she's clearly a brave woman, and the Greens are brave this election by, you know, sticking up for WikiLeaks and its right to publish and its imprisoned sources and so on. That's, I mean, obviously, we hear that as something that is important. It's actually a really good signal that is possible in the U.S. political debate. I mean, of course, whether it's possible for someone like Jill Stein to be elected is another matter.
Well, it's almost impossible for her to be elected.
But she has said these things, and there is some reportage. it's not been smashed in everyone's face like the Trump and Clinton campaign coverage, but there is a little bit.
One of Trump's supporters, Roger Stone, who I know, I actually know Roger Stone. He was on this show, go figure, a couple of weeks back. But he bandied your name. But then, of course, he backtracked and said he didn't know. He didn't have any communication with you. But, he does toss things around.
Roger Stone is a rather canny spin master.
Yes.
And we have not had any communication with him whatsoever.
Yes.
I do imagine his position, he wants to... I mean, he has said nice things about us. I think he said that I was a hero, so, okay, that's nice. We appreciate that kind of thing. So I'm not minded to criticize him too much for doing something that any kind of political operative would do, which is basically to try and get in on get in on our publications in some way by suggesting that he had something to do with it. But actually, no, it's all our hard work and the hard work of our sources.
Right, and you are doing a...
Republicans have not helped at all. If they want to donate money, like anyone else,
yes, that's
they
a
can
thing.
Do that. We'd welcome that.
Well, before...
if they want to give us accurate documents, which we will check, of course, on the Clinton campaign, welcome that. And similarly, we'd welcome it from the Clintons or Stein or whoever.
Maybe you'll get some money from the CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative. Have you...
Yeah, I doubt it.
Now, let me say, but while we're there, people who want to, we're talking to Julian Assange at WikiLeaks in the Ecuadorian Embassy in London. It's 11 o'clock there, is it? 10 o'clock, 10:30?
It's very hot. It's the hottest August in London ever.
It's the hottest. What do we have Celsius?
And there's 33? No air conditioning in the embassy.
You have no air conditioning? I got to tell you, you look great. I see you on television with Jake Tapper the other day. How do you maintain your energy and your health? I mean, you work out of the embassy?
Well, it's an exercise regime. You have to do these types of things. But I am in love with understanding the world and sharing that understanding with other people. It's a bit hard to describe how much I'm in love with that. And have been for many years. And then at the same time, when you're in a conflict, when people are trying to, malign your work or engaging banking blockades or as they are doing, attempting to send me and other people to prison, it's very stimulating. And so you feel energetic under these circumstances. I mean, when you've been attacked.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure it must be an impossible situation day in and day out, but you've done an incredible job. You're, just a remarkable example of strength and hope. And I know you're taking a huge sacrifice when you got into this business. You knew it was possible that something like this would happen eventually. Am I right?
Sure. I actually expected it. Not exactly this, but something close to this. A couple of years earlier, actually, I thought it would happen.
Well, here I just saw the UN has formally found, I think it was actually in February, that that you were unlawfully detained by Sweden and the UK. Can you expand on that?
Yes, on February 5, the United Nations formally found that I am being illegally detained by Sweden and the UK and must be immediately released and compensated. So that's obviously a hugely significant win for us. The UK is, and Sweden so far, have actively defied that ruling. They have paid some diplomatic consequences for it. Hopefully those consequences will increase over time. We have various legal mechanisms that we've tried to put in place, that we are putting in place to try and enforce those decisions. And you can go to justiceforassange.com
right,
with a numeral 4 in the middle, justiceforassange.com.
Justiceforassange.com.
You can see the UN.
I see it right here. So I'm there right now. So people can go there. How do people help out with the legal bills? Is there a...
If you go to justiceforassange.com, there's a donate thing on the right-hand side, and that goes to our general staff defense fund, which to protect me and to protect the rest of our staff.
And so that's one way.
It is quite expensive. I mean,
I know it is.
We have 154 lawyers that are either on our legal team as staff or have advised, the majority advised at some stage during those last few years. All of them are working either pro bono or at highly reduced rates or some just for costs. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's a big team.
The big blow was the loss of Michael Ratner. I know huge blow.
Enormous blow for us in the United States. He was our chief counsel. It was a blow to a number of other groups who are using him. But the primary case he was spending his time on the last couple of years were our various legal cases.
He worked very hard on that case, and I know people associated with him who still are. So that's one way people can donate. They go to justiceforassange.com. And is there any other way people can?
Yes, they can go to WikiLeaks.org, and you'll see a donate thing there. We're tax deductible in the United States and also in Europe. I was just joking with one of my lawyers who was visiting yesterday that this is absurd, like Biden calling me a high-tech terrorist and all these calls out for my assassination. And like, yes, high-tech terrorist, you know, assassinate him, illegal, you shoot the son of a bitch, which is what Bob Beckel, this Democratic
Bob Beckel said that?
On Fex. Let me quote you too exactly. Bob Beckel said... he ought to be assassinated. I'm not for the death penalty. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. Tell me about Beckel. Yes, I'm sorry.
So Bob Beckel
said,
he's a windbag. He's a Democratic strategist. I'm not, he should be assassinated. Assange should be assassinated. And I'm not for the death penalty. So if I'm not for the death penalty, there's only one way to do it. Illegally shoot the son of a bitch.
That's what Bob Beckel said.
That's Bob Beckel.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed.
That's what Bob Beckel said. So anyway, we joke like, WikiLeaks, they're a high-tech terrorist publishing organization that is tax deductible in the United States and Europe.
Well, it's my favorite.
Somehow it doesn't work, right? You can't have tax deductible in the United States and Europe and somehow be
You're on his terror list. You're basically on the hit list by Bob Beckel. Look, I know the guy. I worked at a comedy club in the upper. I forgot who it was for, but he was in the audience and he came up to me completely whacked out on like 9 shots of tequila, and he gave me a beat. He said, "You were great," and that was the only time I ever had any association with Bob Beckel. Look, I can't stand it. CNN, Jake Tapper, I thought was rude to you. I know that Megyn Kelly, you'll be on today with Megyn Kelly on Fox. You were on last night. Part two is tonight.
Yeah.
Megyn Kelly. And how did that go?
Well, Tapper, I didn't think was so rude. Tapper, I didn't think was so rude, actually. I thought he was relatively.
Well, I'm prejudiced.
Polite. But I say relatively. You have to understand that these guys are in the mainstream media. And so. Just in order to justify how they behave, they have to make certain nasty questions. But you can often read whether they're enthusiastically into the attack or whether they feel they just have to go through some of the motions because that's what's expected of them. So for Jake Tapper and for the Fox woman, Megyn Kelly, they were not, you know, their heart was not in the attack. I'll tell you whose heart was in it. Chuck Todd.
Oh, the worst. Chuck Todd. I call him Chuck Fraud. Chuck Fraud is the worst. Of course, he doesn't like you because of that leak in the DNC.
Well, we revealed in DNC emails that he was being called up by Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her crew. And, like, you know, what the hell's going on? They're speaking about Sanders in a particular way and, you know, shut that down.
Well, thank God she's gone, and I wish I would make the trade. I wish he were gone and Wasserman Schultz was still there. I'd prefer to get rid of him because he's a horror show at MSNBC, at NBC, and he's not really a journalist. Jeremy Scahill called him out on the Mara show like 4 or 5 years ago. The guy freaked out. Chuck Todd.
Well, he's close to the Clinton's. And if you see how Meet the Press works.
Supported by Boeing. Boeing underwrites that show.
It's a Sunday show, so they sort of set up what the White House wants the discussion to be in the first part of the week.
I think it's all of MSNBC. I think that they should just
most
move.
Of it, yes.
They
I
should
mean,
just move right into the White House.
Right. I mean, it's an interesting question whether MSNBC is effectively, socially, and in terms of its structure and proprietors and so on, a White House outfit, or whether it is a center of power of the Democratic Party outfit. I think that's quite an interesting question. I'm not sure what the answer is.
Have you been interviewed by Chris Hayes?
I think I might have been once years ago, but he's been, on Twitter at least, he's been slandering us constantly.
He's been slandering you. He's amazing. You know, it was, and I thought the guy did a pretty good job, Keith Olbermann. Keith Olbermann was okay. They got rid of him, you know, because he was too far out there. And they bring in Rachel Maddow, and they bring in Chris Hayes, and they both become attack dogs for the administration.
Yeah, he has Chris Hayes. There's also a middle-aged black woman. I can't recall her name.
Joy Reid?
Joy Reid, right. Yeah, and she has been particularly bad.
Well, it's we call MSNBC. They, you know, if you ever watch them around the clock, you will see half of the programming there is a show called Lockup. Lockup. It's all about this sick, disgusting, rancid, voyeuristic display of prisoners in one of our.
Is it? I haven't seen that.
Yeah, Lockup. And I asked one of the guys, Howard Fineman, at the New Hampshire primary, I was there. And I asked Fineman, I said, how on earth could you be on a show that's underwritten? Because he said, well, it's cheap. It doesn't cost much money. And with the money that they make, it helps pay for Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow. That's what he said. That was the answer. You got to check out Lockup. On MSNBC. Just look it up online. Lockup. It's their flagship show because everything else loses money. Remember, she does not have a big audience. 300,000 people watch MSNBC.
Maddow,
330 million Americans don't watch her. So we shouldn't take them too seriously.
I think they're not really using it to influence. They're using it to influence influencers, right? I mean, that's the point, to help. Get out stories in particular angles, like with Chuck Todd, to kind of set the narrative drum for the week, or to present a defense.
Well, I'm sorry to see that.
To present an attack that will then be picked up and spread. Because, I mean, if you look at the numbers are not what seems to me on the back of the envelope analysis, the numbers are not enough to justify the payment.
Absolutely. It really is not. The numbers are very low. And CNN is okay. How has Wolf Blitzer treated you? Have you been on with Wolf Blitzer?
I think I might have. I don't think so, actually. He had definitely has covered our material. I recall distinctly when we released Collateral Murder, which was about a 30-minute tape of Apache gun camera footage, the first time such footage in high resolution was released, showing an Apache helicopter mowing down 18 people in the suburb New Baghdad in Baghdad, including two Reuters journalists. And Wolf Blitzer, he's even though this was a journalistic effort by us, which in some sense was made for TV because there was very dramatic visual images. He made sure to spin it and only take, you know, one segment, which wasn't as bad as the majority segment. But I mean, you know, he's kind of, if you look at Wolf Blitzer's connections to Clinton and the sort of things that angles he tries to push, I mean, it's not a surprise thing. I think most people in the media industry understand that Wolf Blitzer is quite a partisan figure.
Takes him a long time to say anything. Ever noticed that about Wolf Blitzer? Takes him about 2 weeks to, you know, get out a one-sentence question, Wolf Blitzer. Take a lot of time. He could do one 2-hour show with one sentence, Walt Blitzer. But and
yeah, I mean, it's a shitty job, so I mean,
we're gonna have to. It's okay. We don't care. It's all right. We're talking with Julian Assange, the most wanted person by Bob Beckel. Bob Beckel, what a great guy with the suspenders. What a joke he is. And, you know, so
he's not the only one. I mean, there's been quite a lot of those.
You think Bill Clinton's happy?
Bill O'Reilly, too.
What about O'Reilly?
O'Reilly said I should be assassinated by a drone. And then Mike Grunwald at Time magazine, not so long ago, actually, said he couldn't wait to write the defense of the Obama administration for killing me with a drone.
Wow. Well,
he's a kind of Obama hagiographer. Well, he's now moved to Politico.
It's not
just me. They've also gone for other staff, me as an organization, and of course some of our sources. They've said should be executed. It's, you know, what I find a bit disturbing. You think journalists, whatever their associations are, everyone has associations and friends that they make on the job or whoever they interview. You think that at their core, their number one self-interest is being able to practice journalism.
Right. Yeah?
So you think, okay, maybe they're a bit compromised around the edges, but in the end, they need an audience to listen to them, and they have to be able to say things. So you think that would be their core interest. Unfortunately, it's not true. Actually, they defer to these other interests. They defer what you would assume were their core interests, the ability of journalists to speak freely, to not encourage assassination campaigns against publishers and so on. They easily sweep that aside in order to pander to the interests in the Democratic establishment or Republican establishment or in the arms complex, in banking establishments, etc.
When I think of you, in this country, going back to the 1840s, Elijah Lovejoy. You know who Elijah Lovejoy was, the abolitionist?
No, I don't.
Well, you should look him up, because that was you. In 1840, he was telling the truth way back, 1840. Elijah Lovejoy, he was in Missouri, which was part of the Missouri Compromise. He was anti-slavery, and ruffians came in, and they shut him down. He set up shop again, and they said, you know, enough of this noise, and they killed him, threw him in the Missouri River, and destroyed his printing press. And his brother went on, Owen Lovejoy, to be one of the leaders in the House of Representatives that supported Abe Lincoln. But Elijah Lovejoy, that's you. You're under siege there, Julian Assange. You're a courageous man, and I hope that we can get you back on this show. You have an open invitation to be on this show and other shows. We here at WBAI are huge fans of Julian Assange. I can tell you that. And we got you back here, I can tell you.
Okay, great.
I'll be very happy to be back on. Once again, just give people want to donate, they go to Julian, Justice for Julian.
JusticeForAssange.com.
Or they can go to WikiLeaks.
Or they can go to WikiLeaks and that goes to the publisher.
I got to tell you something. I could have you on for 4 or 5 hours. I really appreciate you being on this show. And we'll be in touch. And anytime, Julian Assange, folks, the one and only, the great, 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 great. There we go. That's him. We're going to play this.
Great.
We're going to play this out for you. Julian, you can hear this. We're going to play this out for you. This is Johnny Cash.
No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got just one life.
All right. All right, that's Johnny Cash. I won't back down. It's a great tune, isn't it? Joining us is my fellow Californian. I grew up in Southern California, very close to where this heroic woman grew up. You're from El Monte, am I right?
No, you're not.
Huh?
I'm what? Not from El Monte.
Wait, you're not
no.
from El Monte? Wait a second. You're from Southern California, though, right? No?
Southern, yes, I am, but Southern California is more than El Monte.
Well, I'm from Pomona, and I admit to it, Pomona. We're on with Cindy Sheehan, who I haven't spoken to since my very first show here at WBAI, which was a Saturday morning show, and you were in, I think, Massachusetts.
Could have been.
Right. How goes it, Cindy Sheehan?
It's going okay, except I'm hearing feedback when I talk, and it's annoying.
Maybe we should put her on this phone here. Can you hear feedback now?
I can only hear when I talk. No, I'm good now.
Okay. All right, good.
I can't hear anymore now.
All right. Well,
I actually was born in Inglewood, California, and I grew up in Bellflower, California, which isn't too far from El Monte. I think it's in the same valley, right? San Gabriel Valley-ish.
I'm in the Pomona. I'm in the Pomona Valley. The Pomona Valley, where's Pomona, 30 miles in, and now you're in Northern California. No, we just had Julian Assange on from London, and I spoke to you earlier today, and you said that you have opinions. I mean, I'm a big fan of Julian Assange. I'm a big fan of yours. You're both born within a week of my birthday, by the way. I'm July 5th. He's the 3rd, and yours is the 10th, I believe. So,
right, yes, exactly.
George Bush is the 6th. He's way too close to my birthday.
No.
That's where I first met you, by
comfort,
the way.
Right?
I first met you down there. I was doing my George Bush impression down there in Waco, Texas. Way down
I know.
There. That's when I first met you. Was that 2005 when you set up Camp Casey? Was it 2005?
Yep, it was.
And I was there with Barry Crimmins. My good friend Barry Crimmins, who's also born on July 3rd, Barry Crimmins. Bill Kuntzer was the 7th of July.
A bunch of cancers.
The only bad one is George
and George Bush.
George
is
Bush.
Actually a cancer.
Ooh, yeah, he is a cancer in society. So look. As far as this election goes, I read your posts on Facebook. They're very incisive and very insightful. And you had put on the other day, what's the difference between Hillary, the military hawk, and Donald Trump, and I forgot what you said about Trump. What is the difference between these two in your mind?
Well, first of all, Hillary Clinton is a known quantity. She has, has decades of war mongering and scandalous behavior behind her, right? I mean, even while she was the first lady of Arkansas, there was a lot of shady things that she and her, politically convenient husband were involved in. And, as Secretary of State, she apparently used the office as fundraising for the Clinton Foundation and influence peddling and things like that, which probably isn't unusual for government, but she's just really blatant about it.
Why would you get in if you weren't? Why would you get in the government? Why would you want to be Secretary of State? She has no idealism. Is there any idealism that you think she has, or just money and power?
Pretty much money and power, for sure. And she's a favorite of the neocons. They've even have fundraisers for her. Kagan is one of her biggest supporters of Project for a New American Century.
We just heard that from Julian Assange, said the same thing. So the neocons, are supporting her. I mean, I don't understand why she's so reactionary. You would think with that background, with the Children's Defense Fund, that she would be this great proponent of civil rights and human rights. What happened down the road there?
I don't know what happened to her, but she's her base, as I understand it, is a conservative Republican. And so she hasn't wandered far from her background and her upbringing. And not only is she a favorite of the neocons, but her mentor and one of her heroes is Henry Kissinger. So, I mean, that says a lot. And what's the difference between Clinton and Trump is that, you know, Trump says some things that are very hostile. You know, some things he said that I actually agree with. And, you know, about his opposition to the Iraq war and things like that. But, you know, his rhetoric can be hostile and can be very provocative and rude. Hillary Clinton's actual actions have been disastrous for many countries. Look at Libya and look at, you know, her support. She gave the Bush administration, whom we were just, you know, we were just ridiculing George Bush, rightfully so, but she gave his administration Democrat cover for the invasion of Iraq. And so we know what has happened and what's still happening there, what happened to my own family. So, you know, the difference is one, actions on the one hand and rhetoric on the other hand. So it's just, I've never, since I've been of voting age, I've never seen such a bizarre election. Have you?
No, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anything like this. Maybe an episode.
I haven't either.
I think maybe an episode of H.R. Puffin stuff or something like that. I've never seen anything.
Right.
I'm serious. This is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my entire life. But it's really interesting that you just said the same thing. It's almost like I'm getting an echo from Mr. Assange. I want to go to this. To this Democratic convention here, all right? And what did you think about Khazar Khan and his wife and that whole episode, Hillary Clinton using those two? What was your feeling when you saw that in the aftermath?
I didn't watch the Democratic convention or the Republican convention. You know, we see...
Neither did I, things, but I heard about it.
Relevant things, you know, on YouTube or whatever. But I didn't know really too much about that speech until people started posting what a difference Trump, you know, Trump said something about, which is like true. He said, why are you attacking me when the candidate you support voted for the war?
And the son was anti-war. The son didn't want to be there. The fact is, I don't know why this guy, where she found him, he gets up there, attacks Donald Trump. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. I got reasons why
either.
I don't like Donald Trump.
It puts me in a weird position.
But why he was chosen, I mean, they must have vetted him a dozen times, a thousand times, and they knew exactly what he was going to say. Maybe they wrote the speech. Well,
wrote what he was going to say.
The whole thing.
And the interesting thing is, the big thing about it, was that people kept on saying, oh, Cindy, you know, George Bush was so much kinder to you than Trump is being to the cons. I'm like, what cons? And when was George Bush kind to me? And so, of course, the Democratic Party is using his tragedy, and it's real, you know, real tragedy. I have so much empathy and sympathy for the cons to further their political goals, like they did to... they used me and the anti-war movement in 2005, 2006. And it looks to me like Khazar Khan is a pretty dedicated Clinton supporter. But, you know, as soon as I left the Democratic Party, when the Democrats stabbed me and the anti-war movement in the back, I kind of just got, I was persona non grata all of a sudden.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of you. And then when I started saying
the same thing about the Democrats, I said about George Bush and the Republicans.
Do you see a difference in the two parties at all?
Not really. In rhetorical style, and maybe you know, some social issues. But in what really matters, war, peace, empire, Wall Street, You know, all of these core, what I consider core issues, the only difference might be that the Democrats are worse, because all of a sudden, when we had a Democrat president for 8 years, the wars have become either people refuse to believe they're still occurring, or they rationalize them based on humanitarian intervention or something like that. So the Democrats, so, I mean, we just look back in our very near U.S. history and see all of the devastating wars that happened when Democrats were in power. And so the difference, I think, is very negligible when it comes to issues that really affect not just the United States, but the entire world.
Right. I saw a photo of you today. Were very close with Hugo Chavez.
You posted it.
That's right. I posted. Well, I found that photo. I hope you weren't. I hope you weren't annoyed with that. It's a great photo of you and Hugo Chavez.
No, I don't. I'm not annoyed with it. I love that photo.
And you must have been a great guy to hang out with. Right. Did you spend a lot of time down there?
I did get to spend quite a bit of time with him on several occasions. I got to fly. One time I went to Venezuela specifically to interview him and for Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. And he actually gave me a lot of time. And we traveled from Caracas to Montevideo, Uruguay, on his plane, which was like 10 hours. It's like a 10-hour flight. South America is enormous. But anyway, so I did. And he really was, I've spent time with U.S. politicians too, and almost to not 100%, but most of them are phonies, they're frauds. But
I've been around a lot of them too. I've been around a lot of those politicians. I can't tell you one that I really – well, there's a couple in New York State, a guy who's the controller, Tom DiNapoli, I like. Uh-huh. But Chuck Schumer.
I kind of like Dennis Kucinich. I'm not pleased with everything he's done, but I think he genuinely cares. And I really think that
Hugo Chavez
genuinely cared about the people of Venezuela.
Yeah, Chavez was a good guy. What do you think now? The rollback of the Chavez movement down there. You got in Argentina, you've got a right-wing president. In Paraguay, Jose Lugo's gone. You're trying to get rid of Morales. And, you know, it's just this huge rollback. And I don't know what's going to happen to Venezuela.
Who do you think is responsible for that?
Hillary Clinton.
Well, she had a lot to do with it when she was Secretary of State. And the
Honduras.
U.S. has been trying to undermine the Bolivarian Revolution of Chavez since it started. And they spend a lot of money trying to undermine left-wing, and not just undermine, but overthrow governments, assassinate people. I mean, it's been ongoing, not just since George Bush was president or Hugo Chavez was president, but really for a couple centuries.
No, of course, we know. It goes way back. If you folks got to read, this audience, they've all read. You must know that they all read Howard Zinn history, People's History of the United States.
I promote one of my books?
Yes, that's why I have you on. That's why I have you here.
I wrote. I was doing a documentary when I went to see Chavez, and for reasons that are revealed in this book, I got all my footage stolen by a colleague of mine, so I decided to write a book, and it's called Revolution, A Love Story. And I finished it right when Chavez was diagnosed. So, I really go back to the Monroe Doctrine and the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, and people like the Dulleses,
right,
and United Fruit and all of
them. Yeah, down there in Guatemala, all over the place, Guatemala, Dominican,
right,
Republic, you name it. Cindy Sheehan, look, we this has been a quick 50 minutes today on the show. It really has gone by quickly. We've had some technical problems, but I just want to make sure people know how to reach you, how to get that book. You have a website, mm-hmm. Cindy, it's Soapbox.
Yeah, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and I have a podcast, a weekly podcast, and
I've been on it before.
I write, and I've been on your podcast, and I post relevant articles that I think are relevant, and things like that. And then, you know, my books and stuff. All my books can be ordered through Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
So it's CindySheehanSoapbox.org or .com.
I think if you just put in Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, you'll get to it.
Okay, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, one long word, basically, put together. And there's no hyphens or anything else, just Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Yeah, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And my email is CindySheehanSoapbox@gmail.com.
Can we get you back on in the next couple of weeks? Because we ran overtime. I had to cut out Zach Fink from New York One, but he knew. Because thank goodness Zach was tied up in editing, and he was going to do a report.
Absolutely.
Zach Fink will be here on Saturday to do a very compelling piece on both Cuomo and on the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. I think they're one person. But we are very, very honored to have you on the show. Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, look it up. Listen to her podcast and buy her book. And we're going to get you back on to do a longer interview. I'm very sorry
Randy. It's always nice to talk to you.
But thank you and I'm sorry that I got the city wrong. All right? I'm out of here. I got to go.
Okay,
we'll see you Saturday morning at 7 o'clock. We will have another edition of You're Crazy If You're Up This Early. Thank you very much, Linda Perry, for giving me this opportunity. And I want to thank Tony Bates, and I want to thank Reggie Johnson, and I want to thank Berthold Reimers and everybody else out there. Thank you very much. Steve, thank you for spreading the word. And Frank and Joe.
Hysteria sweeps one city. Before long, the nation and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of...
On September 26th, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will have their first presidential debate. At WBAI, the WBAI University of the Air and the Commons will present an open mic and forum where people can come and listen and talk about the debate as it is happening. That will be on the night of September 26th at 7 o'clock at 388 Atlantic Avenue between Hoyt and Bond Street in downtown Brooklyn. Come and let your voice be known as to what you think is going on, and listen to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump debate the presidency of the United States.